Hey everyone, it's Reed. Before we get started, this month the Lincoln Project is going to be dedicating itself and our energy to making sure that Americans across the country know the good job that Joe Biden is doing on behalf of the American people and on behalf of the United States. I hope you'll tune into our work and share the content and materials we're putting out with your friends and neighbors. Guys, the next 14 months are as crucial a time as we've seen in our living memory. Go to lincolnproject.us or jointheunion.us to get involved. And now, on with the show. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm joined by the whole gang, and hail, hail, we're all here. Rick Wilson, my fellow co-founder, host of LPTV's The Breakdown, author of the New York Times bestsellers Running Against the Devil and Everything Trump Touches Dies, and if that's not enough, also host of the podcast Rick Wilson's The Enemies List. Rick Wilson, welcome back.
Hey, Reed, how are you?
Also, I am joined by Joe Trippi, legendary Democratic strategist, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project, and host of That Trippi Show, found wherever you like your podcast. Joe, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Reed.
And rounding out the panel today is the one and only Stuart Stevens, also senior advisor to the Lincoln Project, author of It Was All a Lie, and author of the upcoming The Conspiracy to End America, which we'll be talking with Stuart here shortly. His latest title coming out in October and available for pre-order wherever fine books are sold. Stuart, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Ray. Appreciate the pitch.
All right, guys. So lots to discuss today. Things are never quiet in American politics. We'd love it to go back to boring, but we've got a little while. So let's kick it off with the president, Joe Biden. We at the Lincoln Project put out an ad last week as we're recording this, where we explained why we as the Lincoln Project, not Republicans, not Democrats, are supporting in a full-throated manner Joe Biden's bid for re-election next year, and why it's important not only for the country at large, for the world, but also for democracy. So Rick, give us a sense of why we did this, why now, and what we're trying to tell our core voters.
The first part of this, Reed, and I think it's really important, the Lincoln Project was formed when we were all still a bunch of, well, except for you, Joe, God bless you, when we were all still a bunch of Republicans. And we promised America in 2020 that we would apply the skill set we understood of talking to certain Republican voter audiences, that we could persuade them away from Trump. And we did. We were successful in 2020. We were successful again in an even more refined and smart way in 2022. And now we're applying that one more time. So we looked at the political landscape right now, and we recognize there's a big thing, a reality check we had to make, is that Republican voters always want to go home. They always want to go back in the nest. They always want to go back to being Republican voters, even ours. So right now, we've started, while the Republican primary is just like a catfight, we've started to run positive ads for the targeted audience that we address called the Bannon line, which are moderate Republicans, independent-leaning conservatives. They tend to be more affluent. They tend to be more suburban. They tend to be more female. It's an audience we're very good at talking to. We started to run these Biden ads, these positive Biden ads, to talk to them. While the president is running a $25 million ad campaign, it's spread across 14 states, and it's talking to his own base audience. If folks read the Shane Goldmacher New York Times piece on Friday, the 22nd, they recognized in that piece that Biden is now consolidating the Democratic base. We're getting ahead of the curve. We're starting to consolidate the moderate Republican base. As small as it is, it's still very consequential. And we're going to do that as aggressively as we can and spread the message we've done so far into multiple states. We're in Wisconsin now, but we're going to spread it out to Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and other places very soon. And we're doing that because we need to make sure that these people can start feeling comfortable about sticking with the president right now. And doing it now is cheaper and more effective than doing it later. And doing it now gives us a marker for folks to understand what our mission is. We're not here to do everything for everybody. We're here to focus on a right and center-right audience that can be persuaded to stick with a president who's doing one hell of a good job.
And so, Stuart, we now see that a lot of Republicans must have crossed over in 2018 for Democrats to win as big a margin as they did in the House then. They did again for Joe Biden in 2020. They did again for Democratic candidates in 2022. that we now see in a bunch of special elections all over the country and mayoral elections in, you know, notably liberal towns like Jacksonville, Florida, and Colorado Springs, Colorado, you know, that the normal Democrat is beating the MAGA Republican. Is the Bannon line, which, you know, we thought in 2020 was, let's say, 4 to 6% of the party. Do you believe that's expanded in the 3 years since Trump was defeated?
It's an interesting thought experiment. Does anybody know in America anyone who is likely to be a Biden 20 voter and a Trump 24 voter? It seems like you have to hunt those with dogs. That means, in theory, Biden can win if he just gets his repeat customers. It's sort of like the stupid stuff people say in sports, like such and such team is ahead by a touchdown. If that continues, they will win. But if Biden, you know, you replay that race, Biden should win. But the demographics are in Biden's favor. Trump's voters are older. Older people tend to die. There's a huge influx of younger voters that are coming in. And that swing of, you know, what we call Bannon voters, I don't see any reason that they're going to vote for Donald Trump. So the only danger goes back to our old friends at No Labels. If you give them an off-ramp, they could go there that is reasonable. But otherwise, they're either going to stay home or they're going to vote for Biden. I don't see that Trump is doing anything that is successfully going to reach those voters. So clearly he's trying, like his latest stuff on abortion and his stuff going to the union voters. He's trying to. I don't think he's going to be successful in it.
Well, you know, and Joe, there was a survey as we're recording this out of New Hampshire, conducted by CNN and the University of New Hampshire, that has Biden up 52-40, right? 52-40, which is well outside even the margin of error, right? And a couple of notes here. Trump is only at 79 with self-identified Republicans, and his fave-unfave in the state is 30-62, which speaks to a weakness in the primary, which I want to get to. But I want to talk about this because New Hampshire is a famously independent-minded state. Stuart and I were talking about it before we started recording. But this would seem to, you know, throw sand in the gears of the sort of red wave, you know, thing that we had to deal with last year, which is, yes, there's all this polling, and yes, we should not take anything for granted that, yes, maybe nationally they're tied because yada, yada, yada. But in states like New Hampshire, which, you know, could be a bellwether, it sure as hell seems like when independent voters have a choice, it's Biden, not Trump.
No, that's right. And I think, you know, it points to an anomaly that I'm noticing. Biden is doing a little bit underperforming in polls in really diverse states, like California, for instance, New York, where he's dropped down. In other words, if he was at 67, you know, back in 2020 or something, he's now at, you know, 59. But what's interesting is in less diverse, wider states, and this New Hampshire is an indication of this, the numbers you just talked about, 52-40, it actually may mean that the Bannon line is expanding, and that, two, Biden is actually doing better with white voters than he ever has, even with approval numbers and all the worrying and all the hand-wringing in the party. Because if that's true, then you're starting to look at Wisconsin. I mean, a lot of these states start to be a big problem for Trump in a lot of these battleground states that aren't the Californias and aren't the New Yorks, right? So I think there are a lot of numbers in that poll. And the other one was still that 61% of the GOP primary were still looking for somebody other than Trump. So I really think that poll's really instructive of what may be really happening in 2024 that a lot of the punditry is not really looking at and doesn't get.
So, Rick, let's stay in the Granite State for a few minutes and let's turn to Trump. Because, you know, there have been primary surveys. Now, look, we have been saying pretty much since he left office that if Trump wanted to come back, he would be the nominee. I still believe that. But in New Hampshire, as Joe noted, there does seem to be a bit of softness now where you have Trump still well ahead, but now you have three, maybe four candidates that aren't named Donald Trump, either in, you know, low double digits, 10 or 11, or close to it. Now, Ron DeSantis is now in fifth, which is, you know, just a beautiful thing all around. But to Joe's point, like, is New Hampshire a place where Trump actually could lose? Is that a place where, you know, look, we're not a huge fan of any of these people, but like, could a Nikki Haley or a Christie, you know, sort of jump up and bite him? Because the other part, too, is that New Hampshire's always wanted to be, and as Stuart and I know, all too well, has always wanted to be the outlier or the difference. They don't want to be like everybody else.
Right. That iconoclastic nature of New Hampshire, as we've all experienced in different elections and different forms, that iconoclastic sort of stubbornness about New Hampshire, don't tell us how to vote, don't tell us how to think. You know, look, I think part of the CNN poll reflects that there is a divided Republican primary in New Hampshire right now. Nobody's really happy. I think once the primary is over, you're probably going to see, you know, a little bit of acting out there. But I still don't think Trump loses it at this point. But I think you could end up with a good enough performance on Haley's part to perhaps keep her in the fight a little longer, maybe move her up from, you know, third to second in New Hampshire or in South Carolina. But as these other Republicans drop out, there will be a lot of those people that are with other folks right now reconsolidating behind Trump. That's a behavior we've seen a lot of times in the last 8 years is Republicans say, I don't like him, I don't like him, but, and then they make this elaborate excuse and they're like, but, you know, Joe Biden's a communist, and so they have to vote for Trump. It's a known pattern we've seen a couple of times now.
Well, you know, and just one last thing about New Hampshire before we leave the state behind, Stu, is as we're recording this at the Trib Fest, which is the Texas Tribune thing in Austin, Texas, this confab they put on every year, Chris Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire, who would, I believe would only be governor of New Hampshire because his name is Sununu. If it was Carpenter, he wouldn't be governor. And he said this in response to a question. He said, quote, Trump's too dumb to be a danger to democracy. Let's not give him that much credit. I want everyone to relax. It's all going to work out.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's just reflective of this fantasy world that, you know, we talk about that they want to go back to. There's an odd element here of someone who is saying, don't worry about an autocracy emerging, who is using the tools of autocracy to make that point, which is to rewrite history, to pretend that something didn't happen that happened. You know, they want to just look at the Trump years like an aberration, like these are the people that talk about that the party was hijacked by Trump. But the thing about hijackers is they're never popular on the plane. Nobody ever says about the hijacker, yeah, I'm really glad we're going to go to like Cuba instead of where, like to my grandma's house where I bought a ticket. And Trump, if he's hijacking the plane, he's the most popular guy on the plane. It doesn't make sense. He didn't hijack the plane. And this is just a wish fulfillment, you know, a fantasy of somebody like Chris Sununu.
Yeah, Joe, go ahead.
I wanted to say a couple of things about New Hampshire, though. I mean, one, Sununu's wrong. Trump is dumb enough to destroy democracy. I mean, that's actually part of the problem. But the two things I found the most fascinating about, so I beg to differ a little bit with Rick. I'm going to make a different case here. When I looked at that poll, I absolutely just saw immediately that Trump's going to lose New Hampshire. He's at 39, 61% of that state, Republicans in the state are saying they're looking for somebody else. And then if you go add everybody up, it's 59%, you know, whether it's DeSantis, whatever, you know, they add up to 59, which is really close to that number of looking for somebody else. And I think he's got a very low ceiling in New Hampshire. In my view, I think he's going to lose it. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't go all the way, particularly because winner take all later states, all that other good stuff.
South Carolina.
Yeah, yeah. That he doesn't go on and become the nominee. But I do think it creates that schism where there's going to be a fight between him and somebody that he probably vanquishes them. And I agree with all that. But I think that could be very helpful to Biden winning in November. The second thing, though, that I thought was the most important and most interesting thing about that survey was CNN, you know, did head-to-heads, Trump versus Biden, Haley versus Biden, et cetera. And all of them did worse than Trump, but the reason they did worse than Trump was that in every single case, 9 to 15%, and in one case, 20% of the electorate voted for Trump, even though he wasn't in the question. In other words, they asked Haley versus Biden, and 16% said, no, I don't want Haley or Biden, I'm voting for Trump. That just shows you the MAGA cultism that even somebody did vanquish him. And that we've all been talking about this on every time we talk about it, but how are you going to put that together? I mean, so that if he gets defeated by somebody in New Hampshire, I think that part, that where that splits up like that, could really play out in a way that November turns out much stronger than we, you know, I think it's still going to be tough. It's still going to be close. We still got to do all the work. But things could really develop in a way that's very different from what people are thinking right now.
Well, and Rick, that's one thing that is, you know, when I listened to Steve Bannon's podcast a couple of weeks ago, he had some pollster on who said something very similar to Joe, which is if Trump's not the nominee, his numbers, and God knows where he got them from, were 28 million Republican voters would not participate in the 2024 election, which, as I have been saying, says to me that, yes, Trump might lose New Hampshire, but I believe that the Republican establishment and the power brokers will ultimately get behind Trump because they have this thought in their head. And this is what happens when you've made a deal with the devil. We might win with him. We can't win without him, because all they care about is the Senate and the House and power. That's all they care about. So ultimately, like, they'd rather have him, even if they don't want to say it, than not have him, because they know it's a wipeout of maybe epic proportions, historic proportions without him.
We would be looking at a Mondale Reagan numbers. We'd be looking at Carter numbers. We'd be looking at Humphrey numbers. It would be a political nuclear bomb that would ramify down the ticket so far that you could see enormous numbers of states actually flip in their legislative bodies, which I think, and Joe, I don't disagree with you that he's going to lose New Hampshire. I just think we're still going to have consolidation behind him later. But to your point, I think maybe we're seeing, and I don't like to take a lot of lessons out of off-year elections, but I think we're starting to see the things that happened in New Hampshire this week and in other places with these specials, that it's led to the point where there's panic on the official right now. I mean, Noah Rothman at National Review wrote this piece, like, why aren't Republicans getting the message? And if National Review is like, crazy QAnon Trump 1-6 fans aren't really electable, and maybe that means Trump isn't electable, they're starting to panic. They're starting to feel that sweat. And in a weird way, I don't think Trump's legal problems have hurt him, but I think they might be hurting other Republicans. And we haven't really fully processed that.
Support for the Lincoln Project podcast comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who've switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Lincoln. That's odoo.com/Lincoln. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Stu, let me ask about this. So as we're recording this right this week, there's another Republican debate out in California at the Reagan Library. Trump won't be there. He said he's going to go on the picket line with the UAW, even though the UAW said, please don't come here. Is there also a part of it, which is, you know, these early primary states, like, they're all very jealous of their place in the world. And they're all very arrogant about the idea that, like, they want you to come to the diner. They want to size you up. And some of them don't care if their name is Donald Trump or not. Like, you damn well better show up. You got to put the work in.
I think it could be a situation where Trump could lose Iowa and New Hampshire and still win the nomination decisively for all the factors we've talked about.
Well, Biden, that happened with Biden.
It'd be a repeat of what happened with Biden. And, you know, one of the factors here about New Hampshire that you can't calculate in these polls, they have same-day registration voting in New Hampshire. And my experience with this in 2012 was not pleasant when I was working for Romney. Obama overperformed his polling. And of course, there were those who were, you can just picture who they might be, some big dogs who were backing Romney who said, well, they must have cheated. I said, no, they didn't. I know one who actually hired a detective firm to go and look into this. And their conclusion was 10% registered on election day. And overwhelmingly, Obama got those voters, which skewed his polling. I think that same factor would be in effect. Who is going to register for Donald Trump who hasn't registered for Donald Trump on Election Day? And, you know, this is another thing we've talked about a lot in the CNN poll. It says 59% to 37% of New Hampshire residents opposed last year's Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade. And 54% describe themselves as strongly opposed. That intensity is only going to increase as more and more states pass extreme laws. I just don't understand what the message is that is a national winning message for any of these Republicans that they've come up with yet. I think what Trump is doing now is sort of fumbling around trying to find it. I'm going to moderate on abortion by saying the heartbeat, so-called heartbeat bills are wrong. I'm going to try to go on a UAW picket line, even though they don't want me. That's them sitting in a room. And, you know, we said there's smart professionals running the Trump campaign, throwing stuff up against the wall because they're looking for some element they can inject in this general election that doesn't currently exist in the argument.
Well, and but, Joe, that's campaigning by poll, right? Which is, what are suburban women in Waukesha, Wisconsin, or in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, really upset about? Abortion. Okay, so we're going to go and, you know, we're going to move towards, I'm going to say this, directionally, not totally, but directionally towards normal. But of course, he's the same asshole who said in an interview on videotape, I'm the one who created the Supreme Court that got Roe v. Wade overturned, right? So like, it's like, you know, as Stu noted, yes, there's very smart people there, but they're also sort of not taking into account that like the guy says whatever it is he has to say at any given moment to get out of trouble, right? And like, everybody's going to remember that, right? Like, maybe this is what I'm asking, Joe, is like the shtick, like it's not new anymore. Everybody know. I mean, he's always been a liar, but everybody knows he lies about goddamn everything.
Yeah, but that'll work with his base. They don't care where he is on that stuff or what he's saying. They all, oh, I know where he really is. The problem it's creating, I think, for the party writ large is it's exposing the divisions within the party. I think we're seeing this with Ukraine and Russia that Nikki Haley is pointing out. I think there's some real fractures that are starting to develop, including this one that Donald Trump is trying to straddle somehow between the Supreme Court he appointed, overturning Roe v. Wade, creating the Dobbs decision, and, oh, crap, this isn't a winning issue. I got to move away from it. Well, that's what I'm saying. Those cracks are there. And so I don't disagree with either Rick or Stuart about who the eventual nominee is. What I'm saying is I think Iowa, New Hampshire, you know, may exacerbate that fracture. And we've all seen this. Whenever there's a sort of fractious fight within a party, even if the winner is winning 60-30 the entire way, you know, whatever that fracture is, Ukraine, Dobbs, whatever, that's all, is what I'm talking about, November being a much different election, a much different kind of framing with democracy front and center, obviously, but that creates a, you know, something that's not a 47-46 race, you know, at that point.
So Rick, on Joe's point, I remember last fall when we were in D.C. for the Women's March, right? And there was a kid marching next to me who had three buttons on his backpack. It was pro-choice, a rainbow flag, and a Ukraine flag, right? Like, that is a really interesting coalition, right? That is a very interesting coalition. This was a young person, right? So, like, that shows you where they are. But I think also my question is, now, let's turn a little bit to the crazy, which is, you know, they can only contain the crazy for so long. Trump is unpredictably predictable. He's going to do ultimately what he's going to do. And so now you have a situation where, yes, they're trying to moderate on abortion, but now he's going out and last week, you know, said that the MAGAs in the U.S. House of Representatives should shut down the government specifically to ensure that his prosecutions can't continue. So now, yes, he's against the heartbeat bill, but let's shut down the government. So like, this is where the inconsistencies come up and the fractures that Joe's talking about, which is a government shutdown, which only Republicans have ever done. And all of us know always work out badly for Republicans.
Every single time.
He's now encouraging the nuts to do it.
Look, Donald Trump is, it's like Ohm's law in physics. In Ohm's law, electricity always seeks the path of least resistance. And so Trump is trying everything under the sun to not only protect himself legally, but to cause the maximum amount of chaos and noise because those things bring his people home. And so the Ohm's law thing here is, what's the easiest way to try to shut down the Justice Department for a few weeks? Well, it's to have Kevin and Matt and the rest of the crazies do his bidding and shut down the government for a few weeks. It's absurd, but it's so on brand that it's so typical.
Think about the 18 Republicans who are holding, you know, congressional seats where Joe Biden won. And it, essentially what's going on is Trump's calling on MAGA to call all these members and tell them, shut down the government so I don't face prosecution. Well, those phone lines are ringing in those 18 places right now. And they're sitting there between a rock and a hard place because the MAGA folks in their district are banging on them to shut the government down. They know if they do it, it's going to create a huge problem for them in the general. In a district, Biden's probably going to do even better than he did last time. Again, these are the fractures that I think are, you're starting to see them come out into the open in a way that exposes exactly what sleeping with the devil has created.
Yeah. And so, Stuart, you know, I was texting with my dad last night, and my dad, for those of you that don't know, was on Capitol Hill for many years. I grew up going to the Capitol, going to the NRCC, the RNC, all this other stuff. He worked for Quayle when he was in the House and the Senate, worked for Newt as whip and then speaker. And, you know, he said, like, I was like, what do you think? He's like, you know, some people rise to the occasion. McCarthy's sunk to the level of his own ineptitude.
I have to say, put in a plug for Reed's dad. He's one of the smartest people I ever worked with in politics. Who he was in the communication world and really was the best the Republican Party had.
Agree.
You know, yeah, I can remember one campaign that we came in. We talked him into coming in, and it was an utter disaster. And he viewed the situation, and most people would have said, yeah, no, I can fix this. And he was, yeah, this is a disaster, guys. You're screwed. There's nothing you can do.
Right. He also just texted me and asked me for your Venmo account so he can send you some cash.
It was a lesson to me early on that, you know, it's better to tell clients the truth. Nobody looks at Kevin McCarthy and thinks that this is a man of substance. He's often been compared to kind of a Rush chairman in a fraternity, which I think does disservice to the whole greater fraternity community. You know, if you said to him, look, you can be Speaker of the House, but one of your kids is going to go, I think his response would be, well, can I pick the kid? And it's a slow process of humiliation that he's engaged in. And these people hate McCarthy, hate him. The people who would naturally like him, those who consider, you know, the same caucus, they see him selling out to Marjorie Taylor Greene with this weird sort of bond they have. Let's leave it at that. And the people who are the crazies, they think he's just a guy who they have no respect for because they know that they can manipulate him. You know, it really goes to the greatest problem with the party, which is, why does the party exist? What is its greater purpose? And there is no governing purpose. It exists to elect Republicans, which is not a mandate to draw anybody to a growing center-right party.
Well, and, you know, Joe, take us back through some of your history. So there was a shutdown in 95. Clinton gets the better of Gingrich. 2013, singularly led by Ted Cruz, right, who convinced a bunch of nuts in the House to shut it down. You know, then I think there was another one in 2019, right, which I think got resolved pretty quickly because Trump was president. And now we've got another one looming. And you look, and if it's Republicans of any stripe, Democrats of any stripe, McCarthy himself, right, they're all like, this is going to happen. McConnell is saying, don't do this. Mitch McConnell is like, don't do this. And even says out loud, this works out badly for us. And they're going to do it anyway.
McConnell, if nothing else, is not stupid. And the idea that he, who's been around this process for 50 years, isn't going to say, you know, guys, this is a surefire loser. But part of the thing is these days that strikes me is they're so defiant. They want to defy McConnell. They want to say, no, no way. We're not going to let McConnell cuck us. We're going to do that our way. And I just, ugh.
And Joe, that's the thing is, like, McCarthy's on camera last week saying, this is a bunch of parties of one who I guess just want to burn the whole place down. Like, pardon my French, what the f*** did you think was going to happen?
Yeah, it was the most truthful thing McCarthy said, right? And the most obvious. Of course they want to burn the place down. I guess you didn't realize that during the 16 votes they put him through to become speaker. But I do think that the problem here is it's going to happen. And you know, McConnell lives in a completely different world than these guys, right? I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is not worried about, when you say, oh, this could be a loser for us, you know, it's never worked out for us. It's going to work out great for her and Matt Gaetz.
Right, because she lives in Rome, Georgia.
They're not going to lose their seats. It's going to put the country in complete jeopardy. 800,000 people or more furloughed, you know, like in some of the worst ones that I think we're going to, you know, this could turn into. I mean, they couldn't even get, McCarthy couldn't even get defense spending twice now. The defense spending bill has gone down, you know, complete embarrassment to him. They've held him hostage from the get-go. And again, another sleep with the devil. It's all coming home to roost right now.
And so, Stuart, let's go back to that, about your point about why the Republican Party exists. Why does it exist? Because here's the thing, to Joe's point, you know, Republican voters, remember, you go back to, you know, Reagan, you know, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. Those are the scariest words in the English language. But the truth is that while Americans love to bitch about the government, because it's our God-given right to do so, because we're in a democracy, they're also the keep your government hands off my Medicaid.
This was always a fundamental flaw in the party, that even at, let's call it, its modern peak in the Reagan era, there was this fundamental disconnect between, I want to run so I can get elected to run the government, and I don't think the government has a positive role in your life. It's really weird. It's like somebody running for high school president who promises to abolish the office, which happens in kind of like a, you know, screw you sort of funny sense. And the party was able, because of the force of Reagan's personality, and there were building blocks of the party then, right? What were they? They were strong on Soviet Union, strong on the Cold War, crime, welfare, and taxes. So what happened? Soviet Union collapsed, Berlin Wall came down, Iron Curtain came down, taxes have gone down as a percentage of total income for people, crime has plummeted. And the Democrats waved the white flag on welfare when Bill Clinton ran on end welfare as we know it. So that left the party in 2000, you know, where Reid and you and I are involved in the Bush campaign, stumbling to try to find a new platform, a new reason to exist. So for Bush, that was compassionate conservatism. And if you remember, a lot of conservatives said, well, wait a second, George Bush, are you trying to tell me that being a conservative isn't compassionate? And Bush's answer basically was yes. What did that mean? So look at what he did in office. His major piece of legislation pre-9/11 was No Child Left Behind, which, say what you will about the benefits of it, it was bipartisan election. You know, he had that famous picture signing it with Ted Kennedy over his shoulder, which, you know, would be presented now in this Republican Party as a war crimes tribunal proof. And then 9/11 happened, and Bush became a wartime president. So they never developed, they never had a president who could develop this policy. So McCain lost, Romney lost, and then you went to Trump. So there never was a chance for a non-9/11 post-domestic agenda to be developed by the same part of the party. And they never did the work. And it's reflected over and over in these numbers. Trump was able to win. Let's don't forget, you know, Trump won with 46.2% of the vote in 16. Romney lost with 47.2. So you're not expanding the party. It's just a question of the other factors in the third party.
And, you know, that's the other part too, Joe, about the nature of the electorate. And I think I had one of you on about this, is that the number of Gen Z voters that have come online or will come online by next November, since I believe 2016, versus the number of greatest generation, silent generation, baby boomers who are leaving the electorate, i.e. dying, is dramatic in nature, right? It's dramatic in nature. And Stuart has been saying this, and I always sort of temper it, but Stuart has been saying this, right? Which is not new, like, you know, demographics is destiny. And now, you know, whether or not it's the environment, whether or not it's generation lockdown, whether or not it's Dobbs, right? Whatever it is, just at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona, Charlie Kirk goes out there with his Turning Point USA goons, and Flagstaff, not exactly a liberal bastion. And they're giving him the middle finger and they're telling him, get the F off our campus. We don't want you here.
That's exactly right. And I've been saying, we've been talking about this, that this is a moment where the Republican Party, the Trumpism itself, is possibly costing the party a generation of voters in a lot of the same way that the Reagan Revolution and the Carter time cost a whole generation of young people then, you know, fell in love with the Reagan Revolution and registered Republican. And the Republican Party in its current state is losing that generation. And there are going to be far more of them in this election than there were in the last two presidential cycles. And you're right, Reed, you know, far fewer boomers and silent generation members. So that just that shift alone, you know, the Gen Z may be the generation that saves democracy.
Rick, I want to ask you a question. And I was thinking about this in the context of the pro-Biden stuff that the Lincoln Project and all of us individually have been, you know, the ads we put out, the videos we've made, the things we've written. And what I see in the comments, and I know we should never read the comments, is the pro-Biden stuff just drives the MAGA into overdrive crazy, which is hard to believe, right? Because they're in fifth gear anyway. So this is like hitting the nitro button. But Rick, I think it must be miserable right now to be a Republican voter, because think about the things you have to do. Remember in the first Jason Bourne movie, right? When he shoots Clive Owen and Clive Owen's dying in that farm field in France, he goes, look what they make you give, right? Like, look at all of the things you have to give up to now say, yes, this is what I want to be a part of. There's no happy warriors. You're fighting for one guy who hates you, and deep in that brain of your recesses, you know he hates you too, right? I mean, it must be awful to get up every morning and say, this is what I have to be for.
Every day, MAGA voters are looking for outrage. And it doesn't make them happy. The fact that they find something to be outraged over doesn't make them happy. It is a dopamine addiction that they have built in themselves, where they are looking every day for something to validate how pissed off they are about a changing world. And so when we do a positive Biden ad this week, they lose their minds. And it doesn't matter what the statistics are. They are absolutely convinced, because they saw on eaglepatriotwarrior.ru that the economy is a Mad Max hellscape full of mutants eating one another, instead of the strongest GDP growth in the last 70 years. They think that the employment picture is so bleak, it's the Great Depression Part Two. They think gas and groceries cost, you know, 100 times more than they ever have been in the past. It's all a big lie in their heads, but they're always looking for ways to validate it and to be pissed off, because they've come to believe that a feeling of rage is a legitimate expression of political discourse. It's substituted for any sort of intellectual approach to these things. You know, there was a day when you could say, okay, listen, I don't like this Obamacare thing, but I think this or that could work out in it. But now, if you're a Republican, you have to say, it's socialism that will lead to doctors murdering their patients for fun. It's always that, like, they always have to switch into, like, afterburner on everything.
But Stuart, I mean, you know, to just circle back one last time to you and your point, like, isn't that exhausting? I mean, yes, like, the whole idea of being addicted to something is that you get that first hit, but it's never as good as the first hit. And you got to take more and more and more and more of it to even get back to a place where you're not living in a refrigerator box.
One of the hallmarks of movements in American politics, for the most part, is that they have been youth-led and they have been movements of optimism. Being angry is exhausting, like Rick was saying. It doesn't make you feel better. And believing that the world is against you and you are a victim. And we said this before, I mean, say what you will about Ronald Reagan's politics. He took the worldview that if you've been born in America, you had won life's lottery. And inequalities in America, certainly, but no one was disadvantaged in life because you were born an American. Trump changes that, puts it on its head, that because you were born an American, you're a chump, you're a patsy, you're a victim. And there are these powerful forces out there like Canada that are taking advantage of, you know, I'm going to settle the score. You know, this myth that we have in America, you know, home of the brave, you know, now the home of the fearful is the Republican Party. And they're afraid of these imaginary caravans. They're afraid of future. That's really what it is. It's really fundamentally anti-American, which, if you can say anything about America, it has based upon an optimism. That was the American experiment's ethos. And for what they called an experiment, they didn't know if it would work. It's a very, very dark future and dark way to look at life. There's a certain rush you get in the moment of road rage, but nobody wants to live in that moment. It doesn't make you feel better. And I think that's something that the party is struggling with and they don't know what to do with. And there's sort of just no there there except anger.
So let's wrap up on this. So last week in The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, who's the editor-in-chief, had a long-form interview profile story about General Mark Milley, who, as of the end of September, will retire from the Army, retire as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. It's a fabulous article, and it takes you through all of the best and worst of Milley's experience in 4 years in the job, including 2 years under Trump. You know, but Joe, to Stu's point about optimism and belief, there's a story in there where at Milley's investiture as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he has a wounded veteran, a man who'd been badly burned, who was an amputee, sing at his ceremony. And there's a picture of Trump, you know, saying something to the guy, but then saying to Milley, within earshot of others, why do you have people like him around? Why do you have the wounded around? Nobody wants to see that. And I think it's just a reminder, for me anyway, of really how he sees the world. You know, going back to what Sununu said about, like, he's not a danger to democracy. Well, A, he is, and B, he's a bad person. Maybe the worst person.
Absolutely. There's been instance after instance after instance of this stuff. I mean, from, I like the kind that aren't captured, you know, I mean, with hitting McCain. And so it does get to what Stu's talking about and Rick's talking about is, if you just always want to be outraged, it doesn't matter what the outrage is. It's really going to be hard to overcome that, to knock that down politically, I mean. And like I said, you saw it in those New Hampshire results where like 10% of them, 20% of them are still voting for Trump, even though he's not on the ballot. That's how much they need that fix. You know, it's kind of crazy.
But Rick, I mean, the other part too is, I mean, Milley was in the military, has been in the military for four decades, for 40 years, right? He's a four-star general, you know, was a Green Beret, parachuted into Somalia with three other guys, right? He was a brigade commander in Afghanistan, had, I think the number was 242 soldiers die under his command. Remember too, that when Trump went to France, when he was president and it was raining, he didn't want to go out and he made some remark to John Kelly, his chief of staff, whose son had died in combat, a Marine who had died in combat. But also there's this thing, which is Milley, and I think Biden too, because, you know, his service has been certainly very different, which was a belief in something bigger than oneself. And as Stewart has said, you know, what Trump and that MAGA ethos is, everybody's bad, you're bad, I'm bad, it's okay to be your worst self. And that was the thing that I saw, which was in this article by Goldberg, which was, you know, spanned literally the globe as he traveled with Milley, was, you know, Milley, Biden, and so many other Americans really do believe in, as Stewart said, not only in the experiment, but the idea that it is bigger than us, that it is bigger than just lines on a map.
I think the most disheartening part about that article was not that we didn't know that Trump had that particular kind of character. We've known that. We've known it for a long time. But that it reminds me, and look, I think the article is largely favorable to Milley, but it reminds me that everyone knew these things for years, and they didn't leave. They didn't stand up. They didn't walk out the door and go to the press room and go, this guy is insulting the service of a combat wounded amputee. He is contemptuous of them. I can't serve in this administration. And I'm not just putting that just on Milley, because Milley was also there in the Lafayette Square situation. But I know he was conflicted. I know he had a very careful balancing act. I know he was afraid that somebody worse would take over if he quit. I understand those that reasoning. But this was an administration then, and it is an administration in waiting right now, full of people who do not believe that they're on the side of evil. And if you don't walk away from that interview with just how callous and shallow, and this is a guy who is putting his personal aesthetics over the honorable wounds of a combat veteran, and his personal aesthetic that he just doesn't like to look at it. I'm sorry, if you're the commander in chief, you have to do things all the time that are going to send young men and young women into harm's way. Many will be killed. Many will be injured. And if that's not part of your heart, then you don't belong in that office. And as much as people hated George W. Bush, that man spent an awful lot of time on quiet nights and weekends at Walter Reed. And it just contrasted to me so much about the character of any other president. And, you know, and Barack Obama did the same thing. Of any other president, they would never have even allowed those thoughts to form in their mind. If they thought it, they would have said, God almighty, I'm a shit. And they would never in a billion years thought, oh, I'm going to make a comment in earshot of many, many people. I don't want to see that. I don't like that. Nobody wants to see that. Now, look, I'm the anthropologist of the shittiest human being in the world. I've read every goddamn thing about this guy. And what shocks me is, again, it's not just how terrible Trump is. It's how many people know it and still do nothing and change nothing.
Well, that's right. But that's why we're all here. All right, guys, before we let you go, what is something, broadly speaking, that you think that the Lincoln Project community and listeners should hear about? Stu, let's start with you.
I'm obsessed with the Ukraine war. I think it is the challenge of our generation, whether or not you're going to be able to drive as you can today from Paris to Warsaw in 5 years is going to depend upon this. Arguably, whether or not the Chinese will invade Taiwan is going to depend upon the success of Russia. And everything hinges on the leadership of America, which still does lead the free world. And this is a fight of the free world. And we should do everything we can to encourage the Biden administration and every representative to support giving Ukraine whatever they need to win this war. It is a war of genocide. When you say these horrible people like J.D. Vance and this pro-Putin element of the Republican Party, when they talk about peace, they're talking about peace with genocide. And they should be confronted with that. And we should reject that. It is fundamentally un-American not to be for decency and support people who are fighting to control their own destiny. And that's up in the air.
Amen to that. Joe, how about you?
I'll look at the auto worker strike. I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting how that plays out. I actually think that thing can get settled pretty quickly. I think it's fascinating to me how people think it's going to be some kind of a problem for Biden, who's probably the most pro-union president in decades. But I think it's going to be interesting to see, as we record this, that they expanded to a whole bunch of other facilities today. The auto workers did, but not at Ford because of the way the talks are going. And I think one of the things that's happening, looking back at those New Hampshire numbers, I think Biden is actually starting to grow among white working Americans, as a guy who's on the side of workers. And I think this plays into that, and we'll see how it develops.
All right, Rick, how about you?
I am watching the Republican primary slowly peter out. We're seeing the collapse of DeSantis. There's a death pool running in Florida now when he pulls out. We got some intel yesterday that Casey wants him to stay in. His team is now telling him to, quote, preserve his viability for the future. He needs to get out sooner than later. And I'm like, viability for what? Running a Waffle House? I mean, come on. The ego of those people is absolutely spectacular. And his super PAC head, Jeff Rowe, even as of a couple days ago, was still telling people around his old boss, Glenn Youngkin's world, I've got the DeSantis super PAC. If Glenn gets in, we can flip it over to you. I'm sure Ron DeSantis is going to have something to say about that when the day comes.
Well, I would assume the donors would too, considering it's their money.
Yeah,
not
you
his.
Think?
Yeah. In fact, I told a reporter that today. They said, you know, what would happen to the money? I said, you can ask for a refund. It won't be 100%. It would be a percentage of whatever you gave, but you can certainly ask for your money back. It doesn't belong to Jeff Rowe. All right. Well, listen, guys, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, and I hope everybody has enjoyed the conversation as much as I have. You can find Stu Stevens, Joe Trippi, Rick Wilson on Twitter, X, whatever they call it now. Stuart, I had a personal request that you join Threads so that people can find you there. Find that Trippi show. Find the Enemies List with Rick Wilson. Stu, we're going to have you back soon to talk about your new book. Until then, everybody, you can find me on Twitter at Reed Galen, on Threads and Instagram at Reed_Galen_LP. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thanks again to everyone for listening.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to The Lincoln Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or however you listen. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review. To connect with us, follow us on Twitter, at Project Lincoln, and for more information on our movement, to join our mailing list, subscribe to our newsletter, or make a contribution to our efforts, visit lincolnproject.us. If you want to message the podcast directly, please send an email to podcast@lincolnproject.us. And if you want to personally join the fight to save our nation's democracy, visit jointheunion.us. For The Lincoln Project, I'm Reed Galen. I'll see you on the next episode.